Hey, listeners, before we jump into today's episode, we just wanted to send a big thank you to Drew and Caitlin from Tales from the Estate.
Yes, we absolutely do want to say that because we've just embarked on a mouthwatering journey thanks to our incredible friends.
They sent us so many Girl Guide cookies that we can't normally get here in Canada for our snack pantry. It has been amazing.
It really has. We call them Girl Guide cookies. These all say Girl Scout cookies, so I think that's a little bit different. But normally in Canada, we only get two kinds. In the fall, we get Thin Mints, and in the spring, we get chocolate vanilla cookies. That's it. So our minds were opened and blown when we opened our box and found a plethora of cookies.
So many different kinds. And of course, we had to try them all.
We did. Drew and Caitlin are known for doing ratings and reviews, so we thought our way of saying thank you would be to submit our own rating and review of these cookies. So the cookies that we got were the Trefoils, the Adventurefuls, the Tagalongs, Do-Si-Dos, Samoas, Toffee-Tastic, S'mores, and Lemon Ups. And we both agreed that the shortbread, the Trefoils, were our least favorite.
Yeah, weren't a fan.
No, but it was still a good cookie. If I was jonesing for something sweet, I would definitely eat it. Okay, so Melissa, what was your number five spot?
My number five spot went to Adventurefuls.
That was like a brownie-inspired cookie with some caramel.
And sea salt.
And a little bit of sea salt. That was a good cookie.
Mm-hmm.
But my number five went to the s'mores.
Oh, that one made my list just a little higher up.
I thought that was a very well-balanced cookie, and it was so cute. I really liked that one.
What was your number four?
My number four was the Lemon Ups. I love lemon. I did wish that they were a little bit more lemony, but the little bit of lemon glaze at the bottom was a nice little surprise. I liked the sayings on them. I thought that was amazing. They have all these motivational little sayings on them.
That was cute, but they didn't make my list.
They had a good aftertaste. You still could taste that lemon. So they were my number four. How about you?
My number four were Tagalongs. You can't go wrong with peanut butter chocolate mix.
Oh, those were good, but they didn't make my list.
Okay, what did you have at number three? Number three for me was the s'mores one.
I can see why that one was up on your list. But for me, the number three was the Toffee-Tastic. They had little bits of what tasted like score bar, little bits of toffee in there. And they were gluten-free. So for a gluten-free cookie, they were Toffee-Tastic.
They tasted gluten-free to me.
I'm used to gluten-free, so I thought they were a good cookie.
Okay, and then for our one and two spots, I wonder if we have these just swapped. What was your number two?
My number two was the Do-Si-Dos.
Uh-huh.
It was the perfect peanut butter cookie.
That was my number one.
Was it?
Yes, and I think your number one is my number two.
Samoas?
Yes.
Okay, honestly, the Do-Si-Dos and the Samoas, we could eat those all day long.
They were good.
They were really good. The Samoas are a mix of coconut, caramel, and a little bit of chocolate. So good.
And I personally like the Do-Si-Dos the best. Who doesn't like a peanut butter cookie? It's just classic.
It really is. And they did it so well.
So a massive thank you to Drew and Caitlin for your generosity. We really appreciate the extra snacks in the cupboard.
We do. We are going to enjoy finishing all of these off.
And they definitely keep us going.
They do. And if you made it this far, listeners, thank you. You're a true fan for listening. But if you skipped forward till you heard the music, that's okay too. We just had to reply to Tales from the Estate for this wonderful gesture.
It was awesome. And now we'll get to today's episode.
Hey, listeners, thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa, and this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers. Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
Thanks for joining us today.
We are glad that you're joining us this week. And I'm excited to tell this case. I'm excited to see what you're going to think.
Oh no, am I going to get riled in this one?
You always get riled, so I can't say that you won't.
What? I don't always get riled, do I?
A lot of the times you do.
I'm sorry, you guys.
In this one, we're going to be talking about some unusual motives, or at least proclaimed motives.
Okay.
When a murder takes place, there is always lots of questions asked. Who did it? How they did it? And of course, why they did it. And the motives are why we dig deep. And for this case, there is no shortage of suggested whys.
Suggested, but not confirmed.
That's right. Some motives suggested were plausible. Others were convenient. Some were maddening. And one was utterly ridiculous in this case.
Oh.
It would be the ridiculous motive for this dirtbag's actions that would be given the most attention in law books and be the most memorable, even if it wasn't exactly accurate. That's because it was the excuse accepted by the jury and the one responsible for allowing this dirtbag to get a lighter sentence.
Really? So this case is actually in law books to be studied?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
It appears in law books all over the place. Today, we're going to talk about the dirtbag, Daniel White, and his supposed Twinkie defense and the real motives around his actions.
Twinkie defense?
I said Twinkies.
He ate too many Twinkies?
Yes.
And the sugar made him delirious?
Exactly.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. So you can become a dirtbag as long as you eat too much sugar first.
Mm-hmm. And get off.
Interesting.
Daniel James White was born to Charles and Eileen White in Long Beach, California on September 2nd, 1946, and was the second of nine children in a working-class Irish-American family. His dad, Charlie, worked as a firefighter for the San Francisco Fire Department, and Eileen had completed her schooling to become a nurse, but she willingly gave all that up to stay home to raise her children. Daniel had three brothers and five sisters. And I'm sure you can imagine that their house was a busy one.
Oh, I'd say.
But there was order in the chaos. With an ex-naval officer as a father and a nurse who knew how to run an efficient and busy ward as a mother, it was only natural that order prevailed in their house.
I think you would have to when you have nine children.
Yeah, that would be the only way to survive.
Yeah.
The children grew up in the Visitation Valley neighborhood in the southeast part of San Francisco. It was an area that was affordable to live in and attracted a diverse culture as the family grew up. But while diverse, it maintained its sense of community and responsibility for looking out for one another that had begun with its early Irish and Spanish settlers. The children were sent to Catholic grammar school, and the White home was reportedly a loving one. The children were taught a strong sense of right and wrong, and that you help out when you can. In the early part of the 1960s, Charlie was diagnosed with cancer and passed away in September of 1962, just a few weeks after Dan's 17th birthday.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. The community mourned with the devastated family. Charlie had been a celebrated hero of the community, twice receiving awards for rescues that he had performed under harrowing situations. The year that he died, he had actually been selected to receive another award, the Firefighter of the Year Award. Sadly, this award had to be received by his family after his death.
Aww.
It was around the time of his father's illness and death that Dan was expelled from Archbishop Reardon High School in his junior year for violence. I couldn't find any detailed reports about this violent incident or what it was about, and I don't know if there's any connection between his father's death and the expulsion. But the timing is curious, especially when in his next high school, Woodrow Wilson High School, he went on to be valedictorian.
Oh, I would 100% believe that he was having a hard time processing his emotions.
I'm very suspicious of that, because prior to the incident and after it, Dan was described as an eager and charming boy and a gifted athlete.
Oh yeah, his whole world had just been literally turned upside down.
Right, but this violent incident, whatever it was, did show that there were underpinnings of a quick temper that could be dangerous when challenged or on the rare occasion that Dan let his emotions surface. So if he was emotional, he had the potential to become violent.
Okay.
When he graduated from high school, Dan enrolled in the Army in June of 1965. After completing basic training, he returned home briefly for his mother's wedding to one of their father's friends from the fire department who had also been recently widowed. The new marriage was one that made headline news because Eileen, with her nine children, married a man with eight children.
Ooh.
Yeah. And they put the fabled cheaper by the dozen to shame with 17 children aged 9 to 23.
Holy cow.
That is a lot of teenagers in a house.
That's a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a huge span of ages either.
Practically all teenagers.
Yeah. And they must have had some that were the same age.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But both of them had been in good loving relationships, had lost their spouse, and then came together.
That's right.
So it really is a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story. But I'm betting that Dan was initially pretty happy about his assignment in Vietnam just so that he could escape the house.
Oh, I doubt there was very many places you could go to find some peace and solace.
Yeah. In the 101st Airborne Division, Dan rose to the rank of sergeant and was honorably discharged in 1971. After that, he briefly worked as a security guard in a school in Anchorage, Alaska, and then headed back to California. From accounts by friends later in life, Dan could be a little unpredictable with his living arrangements and his choice in lifestyles. One minute he would be living on a boat, getting by with just the bare essentials, and the next minute he would be buying luxury sports cars. It was nothing that set off alarm bells for anybody, but he seemed to be a little bit all over the place with his life's direction. He seemed to have this kind of knee-jerk reaction to situations, and that was a trait that would continue throughout his life. Once resettled in California, he joined the San Francisco Police Department. The job with the police didn't last very long. While Dan was a likable guy, his strong sense of right and wrong and fairness got him into some really deep water. Throughout researching this case and reading all the newspaper articles, it was interesting to wade through all the biases that I found. It was also fascinating to follow how each person's story was spun in the media to fit a political agenda.
Ooh.
So I had to take every story with a grain of salt, like this story about why Dan left the police department. It was later given by Dan's campaign manager, who would have a vested interest in making Dan appear in the best light.
Oh, campaign manager.
Yes.
Oh, we are going political today?
We are going to get really political today.
Oh, we do not do that often.
We don't, but we're going to try and tackle it today.
In the most neutral of ways.
That's right. And so this is why I'm bringing up that it was interesting wading through all the biases when I looked at all of these political agendas and different angles for stories being told from each person's motive behind them.
Oh, absolutely. It's to the extreme for them tooting their own horn, how amazing I am and look how great he is, compared to the opposing party trying to drag him through the mud and tarnish his name.
Right.
So the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
And I'm just going to tell you the facts today, and people can decide for themselves where they think the truth lies.
Okay.
But I think you're right. I think it's somewhere in the middle. So this story about why Dan left the police department was later given by Dan's campaign manager, Ray Sloan. And I could find a paper trail to back it up.
Okay.
Dan left the police department after he went against his commanding officer and filed a report against another officer for beating a black prisoner when he was handcuffed.
Oh, no.
Yes. Dan had stopped the beating, but didn't feel like that was enough. He wanted it to be a message sent to everyone that what had happened was wrong. And he also felt that he wouldn't always be around to stop the beatings. So he really felt strongly that he had to set a precedence. It wasn't fair and something had to be done about it.
For sure. Something should be done about it.
Dan was definitely an idealist. And some even described him as being kind of rigid with those ideals.
But beating a prisoner because of the color of their skin is not ideal.
No. And that's why he was sticking up for it. His idea was, no, this is wrong. And it doesn't matter who did it. It needs to be reported.
Absolutely.
But reporting a fellow officer is not something that's usually done now, let alone in the 1970s. And arrangements were made for Dan to leave his policing career over the incident.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the dirtbag officer who had beaten this man, it was Dan who had to step down.
Yeah, after he went against his commanding officer and still filed the report.
Oh, that's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
He was being punished for trying to do the right thing.
That's right. But to Dan, it was worth it.
Okay, I have to remember that we're talking about the dirtbag because right now it sounds okay.
Wait till we get into it. I think you'll see that this story and along with several others play into his personality and how he became a dirtbag. After leaving the police department, Dan was accepted into the San Francisco Fire Academy in 1974, following in his father's footsteps. At the academy, Dan found himself again fighting for the rights of others. In the mid-1970s, the San Francisco Fire Department was under a federal consent decree to hire more minorities. But the department had found a workaround by allowing African Americans initially into the academy, but then finding reasons to flunk them out of the program.
Whoa.
Yeah. The written exams were reported to be a stumbling block for some individuals.
So they purposely made it hard for some.
Yes. Dan did very well at the academy in both the physical fitness and on his written exams. But when he found out that three of his fellow cadets were about to be discharged from the program based solely on their academic scores, he circulated a petition amongst the senior officials, asking that the three be allowed to stay. Dan was aware of why the three cadets had difficulties with the written exam. He had come to know these individuals. He felt that they were perfectly capable of doing their job and that they would make good firefighters. They just needed a little bit of help getting through the written exam, and he was willing to help. If they were allowed to stay, he committed to volunteering to tutor them and see that they passed every exam.
Wow. Again, I have to remind myself that this is the dirtbag.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really wondering where all these Twinkies and sugar comes in that's going to make him do something bad.
Oh, it was all the Twinkies, Christy. Again, from this experience, it seemed that Dan wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty for a cause that he believed in. That, along with his strong sense of responsibility for those around him, made him a natural leader. At the fire station and in the community, Dan's leadership abilities and his fighting spirit were noticed, and it wasn't long after he married Mary Ann Burns, a grammar teacher, in December of 1976 at the age of 30, that people were talking politics for his future. San Francisco had recently implemented a change to the way that officials were elected to the city's Board of Supervisors. And I'm not sure if I understand it all completely perfect, because politics are very different from country to country. But it sounded like this Board of Supervisors was like what we would call councillors in our local municipal governments.
Okay.
They were a legislative body that passed policies and ordinances for the city and the county by representing the people in the district where they were from.
Okay.
So it sounds just like our councillors.
Yes.
In years prior to Dan running to be a supervisor for District 8 in San Francisco, previous supervisors had been elected by votes tallied from all over the city. The new way to elect an official saw that each district would vote for the supervisor they wished to represent them. So you're getting that area's chosen person. It doesn't sound like a huge change, but actually it really was. It allowed for more grassroots politicians and local activists to run instead of just those that were backed by money and connections.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Dan was absolutely energized by the possibility of the people in his district being represented at City Hall, because they had never had that before. Having a representative from each district meant that that person who lived and worked in the community had a seat at the table where decisions were being made for the city as a whole. He saw it as a way for fighting for his neighbors and making a difference in his community, a responsibility that he took very seriously. Dan was introduced to Ray Sloan by a fellow firefighter, just as he was gathering signatures to run for the supervisor position. Sloan said his first impression of Dan was that he was a complete novice when it came to politics. He had his little handwritten list of about 300 supporters that his wife had written up, and he only had a high school education.
Okay.
But his opinion of him soon changed when he learned about his past of sticking up for others, and the recently published articles about the local All-American firefighter saving a woman and her baby from the 7th-floor apartment building was an absolute dream to a political campaign manager.
Oh, it 100% would be.
Yes.
This is your community superhero.
That's right. Sloan said it wasn't just a story, though, and he was quickly won over by how Dan connected with people, all types of people. He wasn't afraid to go and campaign in areas where other politicians wouldn't dare to go. Sloan said Dan wasn't much of a public speaker in front of the camera, but one-on-one, he connected very well with people. He was well-known in his district as well. One book written on the murders recounted that when Dan walked down the street, he, quote, seemed like he knew everybody's name. He would walk up and down San Bruno Avenue, and people would come out of the shops yelling, "Hey, Danny, Danny, Danny boy."
Really?
Dan had a knack for making people feel heard and getting to the heart of what really mattered to them.
Sounds like a local celebrity. I could just see him walking down the street. Hey, how's it going? Hey, Danny boy. Hey, Dan.
He just connected with people, and he was able to draw out of them what mattered to them. In District 8, what really mattered was the crime rate and employment. Dan, who grew up on Han Street across from the projects, regularly visited them during his campaign. On weekends, he played tackle football with a street gang named the Sons of Sunnydale. Dan would promise to help open up jobs that could support their families and would later arrange for many of them to work on the construction of Pier 39. Because of this involvement with the group, they campaigned for him, distributing literature and attending all of his functions, which created quite a stir. The functions were sometimes criticized as being overly boisterous, and Dan was told by others that he should discourage the group from coming out to his functions. Dan would tell the critics that, quote, these guys are a part of his district and they had every right to participate.
Well, they did. They were his ball buddies.
Mm-hmm. All of this led to Dan having a pretty loyal following of people from District 8.
Well, because he's embracing everybody and then sticking up for them.
Mm-hmm. That, coupled along with his background in law enforcement and the huge support he received from his fellow firefighters, Dan, as the underdog, easily beat out 12 other candidates in the November 1977 election for his seat on the 11-person Board of Supervisors.
Oh, I believe it. He'd even been in the military.
Yeah, he just checked every box.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. His campaign sounded like it was an incredible success, considering it was run on next to no money. Of course, that was all the story being told by the organizing campaign manager.
Right.
His point of view.
Okay.
But it did sound like he really felt like Dan was going to be his ticket to success in politics.
So when he talked about everyone rushing out of their shops to say hello when he'd come down the street, maybe one guy did it once.
Maybe. It did sound like Dan had a good relationship with his community. When he was elected, his campaign manager, Sloan, would continue to be Dan's right-hand man, his official aide, while he served in office. He unfortunately would get a front row seat to Dan's downward spiral. The cutthroat world of politics was not a world that Dan was prepared for. It would be a fantastic world if politics ran on the ideals. But I think most of us would admit that that is far from how the wheels of change turn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Decisions aren't always made on the greatest good, but instead are based on hidden agendas and angles. And an if you scratch my back, then I'll scratch yours mentality.
Oh, yes. We have seen this many of places, many of times.
Yeah. And I don't think it's localized to just our area or our country.
No.
I think you could apply this situation to any politics in any country.
Oh, I am sure.
Yeah. In 1978, the Board of Supervisors that was formed that year was different than it had ever been, with new supervisors eager to represent their own districts instead of the core downtown. By 1978, several minority groups were represented and the board was pretty diverse. Ella Hill Hutch was the first African-American to take a seat on the board. Gordon Lau was the first Asian-American. Harold Ruth Silver was the first feminist. Yes, feminist was actually a district designation in 1978, like gender or ethnicity.
Wow. Good for all of those people.
And Harvey Milk was the first openly gay official in the U.S. ever to be elected.
Is this the Harvey Milk story?
It is.
Oh, I did not even clue in.
There have been many movies and books written from Harvey's perspective.
Yeah.
I find it so fascinating that this case is actually more well known for being labeled the Twinkie defense. And really, even that was twisted. Twinkies weren't his defense.
It was the most sensationalized one.
That's right. And so a lot of the story behind why this murder occurred or the motives that Dan White had were pretty sensationalized to build up different agendas. Dan White made up the fifth newcomer and the 11th member of the board. The board was split pretty equally, with five supervisors that tended to vote more liberally and six that voted more conservative. Harvey Milk was born on May 22, 1930, in Woodmere, New York. He had earned his teaching degree at New York State College and had joined the Navy and worked on a submarine in the Korean War. In 1972, Harvey moved with his boyfriend to the Castro, the heart of San Francisco's gay community. When the Watergate scandal took place in 1973, Harvey was angered by the political cover-ups that were revealed and decided to enter the political arena hoping to produce change. The new election process for the Board of Supervisors was an excellent place to start his political career.
Oh, it would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know how they say, if you want to see change, be the change.
That's right. And both of these men are being driven by that. Harvey ran for election as a city supervisor 3 times before he succeeded. On his 3rd attempt, it was when they had changed the rules about his own community voting for him. Harvey believed that for the LGBTQ community to be taken seriously, that it had to be seen. And so he sought out opportunities to attract attention. It didn't go over well at first, but gradually he gained a following, and the gay community nicknamed him the mayor of Castro Street. He was elected in the same election as Dan in 1977. And just to give you an idea on Harvey's fun-loving antics to get attention, if you haven't seen any of the movies or the documentaries about him, on May 21st, 1978, the day before Harvey's last birthday, he dressed in a clown costume and ran up to cable cars shaking the hands of random tourists and declaring, "Hey, I'm a supervisor. I pass laws. I run this city." Later that night, he attended a series of political events, still dressed in a clown costume.
Oh, we all know how I feel about a clown costume. But he's just showing, "Hey, I'm a regular person."
Yeah, he was a little bit out there, but he knew that media was the way to bring attention to issues. He pleaded with the LGBTQ community to be an open presence, saying, quote, "Every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family. You must tell your relatives. You must tell your friends, if indeed they are your friends. You must tell the people you work with. You must tell the people in the stores you shop in. Once they realize that we are indeed their children, that we are indeed everywhere, every myth, every lie, every innuendo will be destroyed once and for all. And once you do it, you will feel so much better."
Wow.
He was a huge activist for the LGBTQ community.
And quite a leader, it sounds like.
He was. Harvey was committed to bringing attention to an issue no matter what it took, whether it made him popular or not. More often than not, it didn't make him a very popular person, especially in a conservative population. In November 1977, shortly after being elected, Harvey made a tape recording because he had received so many death threats.
Oh.
The political will said that, quote, "If a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door."
Ooh, that is very profound.
Mm-hmm. He was a brave guy to keep fighting for what he believed in. And it wasn't just the LGBTQ community that Harvey fought for. He quickly became an advocate for almost every marginalized group and fought for equality for all, regardless of gender, race, or sexual orientation. There are a lot of documentaries, books, and movies on what an incredible person he was. And what he was able to accomplish in his life is really quite impressive. Unfortunately, his life would end too soon by the unexpected Dirtbag Dan. As newly elected officials on the board, Harvey and Dan seemed like polar opposites. Harvey being obviously the liberal one, and Dan being the conservative one. It should have put them on opposite sides of the table, but it actually didn't. They shared a lot of things in common.
I was just going to say that. They have a lot of the same views in life, mm-hmm. that everybody should have a voice and everybody should be protected and cared for.
Exactly. They both came from working class families. They both had military backgrounds. And they both shared this passion for doing what was right. They agreed on the fact that big money interests muddied the waters of what needed to be done in their communities, and they shared a fighting spirit, neither being easily pushed around, especially when it came to sticking up for the little guy. The media loved juxtapositioning these two people, but in interviews where they appeared together, they were mutually complimentary of each other, and that continued off camera, according to many others. It was even evidenced by Dan inviting Harvey to his son's baptism. Harvey was one of only 3 colleagues that Dan invited to the family ceremony.
Well, that says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Why does this have to turn out so bad?
I don't know. Politics gets in the way.
Yeah.
In the spring of 1978, both Dan and Harvey were working on their own agendas. Both had their own idea of what they wanted for their district. But Harvey's was a little bit more ambitious. He was campaigning against the Briggs Initiative, a statewide ballot measure that would have made it illegal for gays and lesbians to teach in public schools.
Oh.
It sounds so ancient.
It does now. And I guess this was a lot of years ago, but really, if you look at history as a whole, this was not that long ago.
It's true. For Dan, he was opposing a proposed facility for juvenile offenders who had committed serious crimes like murder, arson, and rape opening in his district. The Catholic Church wanted to build the facility, Youth Campus, on convent property in the Portola neighborhood, but needed to change the zoning ordinance to do so. Despite being Catholic himself, Dan was against the facility being built in his district that was already struggling with crime rates. And it was a view that was held by a lot of his constituents. So he wasn't just going off in left field, he was actually representing the general feelings of the population.
Okay. So he's opposed to having this built there.
Yeah. It sounded like he felt building that facility would increase the crime rate in his district.
Okay.
To make matters worse, word on the street was that the church had bullied some petitioners into supporting the idea by saying that they would go to hell if they didn't support it.
Oh my.
Mm-hmm. And that is how it had gotten enough support to take the project to the board for approval. So Dan is not happy about this.
No, no one should be strong-armed into voting a certain way.
No, Dan's Irish spirit came through in full force as he lobbied for board votes against the rezoning that would allow the facility to be built in District 8. Of course, Harvey's battles were more immediate and far more popular in the media, gaining him a lot of coverage, but that didn't disrupt the two's friendship. Dan respected how Harvey stood up to the Goliaths that he was against, and on several occasions, he voted in Harvey's favor on several issues leading up to the Briggs Initiative vote. Dan voted with Harvey to save the Pride Center, which served as a meeting place for gay veterans and seniors. He voted for a resolution honoring a lesbian couple on the occasion of their 25th anniversary. And at a committee level, he voted for the Gay Rights Ordinance, Harvey's premier legislation that would protect the people of San Francisco from losing their jobs simply for being gay or lesbian.
Yeah.
Dan was such a reliable supporter on gay issues that Harvey's aide was quoted praising him in a gay newspaper saying, quote, "A really neat thing is how supportive some people around here have been, Dan White in particular. He's supported us on every position, and he goes out of his way to find out what gay people think about things." On several of the issues, supporting Harvey meant that Dan was voting on the opposite side of his fellow conservative board members, which didn't gain him a lot of popularity in their books. But Dan believed in what Harvey was trying to accomplish.
And politics should not be about popularity. It should be about doing what's right.
Right. It should be.
In a magical world.
That's right. In the ideal world. And that's definitely what Dan believed. He believed that if it was the right thing to do, then of course he would support Harvey. In return, Harvey backed Dan in his appointment to the Streets and Transportation Committee. On the Friday before the youth campus issue came before the board, Dan asked for Harvey's vote of support on his issue. Harvey made the comment that was overheard by Sloan saying that Dan had really earned his paycheck working on this issue. Both men, Dan and Sloan, counted Harvey as being in their corner on the youth campus issue. It wasn't how Harvey voted on the issue on the following Monday.
Mm.
The vote for the youth campus was seen as a liberal issue and therefore garnered Harvey's support. The liberal vote, plus a few of the conservative votes from the members that Dan had ticked off by voting for Harvey, meant that Dan's issue that he had put his time and energy into had failed, and failed in front of a chamber full of his constituents that he had invited to witness.
Oh, so his pride is hurt.
Yes. Dan stormed out of the meeting saying about Harvey, quote, "I guess a leopard never changes its spots," referring to him taking the liberal stance on the issue.
So did Harvey just vote because that's the way liberals were voting, or is that actually how he felt?
I think it's actually how he felt.
Okay.
That he felt that the city needed a youth facility, and it didn't really bother him that it was in District 8. He just saw the greater need for the city was a youth facility that would help address some of the issues.
Right. And it didn't really matter what district it was put in.
That's right. Because it wasn't his district. For Dan, this was a huge betrayal. Harvey, his friend, had voted against what he felt was the right thing to do for his district.
And hadn't told him ahead of time that he was going to vote in the way that he did.
That's right. He had been kind of sly about it. He felt the only reason for Harvey to do so was to gain votes for his own issues. Dan was completely disillusioned, and all of his idealistic views about making a difference in the world came crashing down fast. Dan had been putting in countless hours on his initiative to the detriment of his family, and now he felt like it had all been for nothing. Dan's life since becoming a supervisor had been affected a lot as he navigated his way in the political arena that was entirely new to him. He had had to give up his job and income as a firefighter because of a provision in the city charter that barred anybody from holding two city jobs. In an effort to support his growing family, he had started a new snack food business at Pier 39 in partnership with Sloan. But that failed miserably because there was no way that Dan could keep up running a restaurant and the pressures of being a counselor. That left his family struggling to survive solely on the supervisor's salary of only $9,600 a year.
$9,600 a year?
Yeah.
Do you have that calculated into today's terms? Because that doesn't seem like a lot.
No. It would be about $45,000 today in US or $61,000 Canadian.
Okay.
It's not crazy low, but...
But in today's economy, it's not great.
Yeah. It would not be easy. Because it wasn't easy, Marianne had to return to work and their infant son had to go into daycare.
So that would be hard for any family.
Yeah. And it seemed what was harder for Dan was that his wife was now back at work. She wasn't able to be home with their son who had to go to daycare. He wasn't seeing his family a lot. And so he was upset by all of these things happening. And he kind of felt that it's okay because I'm making a difference for my district. But then when his initiative failed, he was like, all of this has been for nothing. My family has been sacrificing for nothing.
You can see how he would feel that way. But at the same time, who doesn't have that happen in their life from time to time?
Exactly. But Dan was a guy that took everything so seriously. And now he felt just the weight of the world on his shoulders. And he smiled less and less. To increase the pressure that he was under, opponents to his election were making false allegations against him that he had taken money from big corporations and not recorded it in his campaign totals.
Oh no.
Dan was receiving a lot of negative publicity because of it, and it had an impact on his mental health and his family relationship. Months later, the district attorney would rule that the allegations were unfounded, but that part of the story never made it into the headlines. Dan was also under pressure from the group, the Black Panthers, and felt fearful for his safety, as many other supervisors did. There was a lot going on at this time.
Sounds like it.
After the youth campus rezoning passed, allowing the construction to begin in his district, Dan sunk into a depression and his mood became vindictive, and a big shift in his lifestyle habits occurred. And a lot of people said that this was kind of out of the blue. But I think if you look at Dan's past history, there were several times that he did this kind of big shift in his lifestyle.
It's true.
But Sloan said from that point on, everything changed. Dan completely lost interest in his political career. He stopped working out and abandoned his once healthy diet in favor of store-bought sweets. He didn't show up for work for over a week. And when he finally did show up, it was on the day that the board was scheduled to take the final vote on Harvey's gay rights ordinance. Dan was the only supervisor to vote against it that day.
Oh, so he's being petty.
Yeah, totally petty and vindictive.
Yeah.
And if that wasn't enough to spite his friend, he began to publicly denounce the gay parade to the media.
Oh, he's spiraling.
Mm-hmm. Dan began to vote no on everything that Harvey proposed at board meetings.
Okay, that's a dirtbag move. Yeah. Because then you're no longer voting to what you actually believe in. You're just doing it to get revenge, which is an abuse of your power.
Yeah, it's just so wrong. For those that knew what was going on behind political doors, it was very clearly a knee-jerk reaction to get back at Harvey. But to the media, Dan became this conservative poster child for, quote, defender of the home, the family, and religious life against homosexuals, pot smokers, and cynics.
Oh my goodness.
That's actually how the Times wrote it.
Really?
Yep. Originally, when they began their career, they juxtapositioned these two political opponents, and now they're really going wild with it.
And people who have those dirtbag views are just jumping on the bandwagon now.
Mm-hmm.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah. As the summer passed, Dan showed up at his city hall office less and less and avoided his constituents, the ones he had been so eager to greet on the streets and talk to before. When he did show up at work, it was clear he wasn't handling the pressures of political life very well. Then, on November 10th, just 3 days after the Briggs Initiative was defeated, Harvey's political goal, without consulting anyone, Dan handed in his resignation into Mayor George Moscone. George, too, was a politician from a working-class family and was born on November 24, 1929 in San Francisco. He was raised by his mother after his parents divorced, and in high school, just like Dan, he had excelled in academics and sports. After completing law school and marrying his childhood sweetheart, he moved into the political arena to fight for the rights of the working class and the minorities, just like Dan. Previous to becoming the mayor, he had been a county supervisor and a senator. Now in the mayor's role, it was his job to define budgets and oversee department heads to ensure the running of the city. The mayor plays an influential role with the board of supervisors in determining commissions. And commissions are a very powerful role in the city. The roles were really intertwined, but it sounded like it required a certain amount of finesse to work in between everybody's roles to get things done for your own agenda.
Okay.
Because of his role, George, just like Dan, understood the pressures of being in politics. When Dan handed in his resignation letter right after Harvey's gay rights bill got passed with the support of George, I'm guessing it was a shock to George, as it was to everyone else.
That Dan was resigning?
Yes.
Okay.
Because what Dan was facing wasn't any different than anybody else was facing. They were all kind of working their own angles and agendas. You had to give a little, you had to take a little, but Dan wasn't getting this.
Well, and Dan was used to being this superhero that everyone was running out of their shops onto the street to say, hey, Danny boy, and patting him on the back.
Right. And now he wasn't that person. And he didn't like to bend his ideals at all to get things done.
And it's a long fall from a high horse.
That's right. It wasn't as if it was a secret that Dan was struggling, but it was a shock to everybody that he would be willing to quit after just a few bumps on the road as he navigated the new learning curve of operating in politics.
Right. Because how long had he been in politics at this time?
Just under a year.
Yeah. So he's still...
He's a newbie.
Yeah.
Dan told the mayor, George, that it was because of financial worries that he had to quit, that his personal responsibilities to his family must take precedence over his legislative ones. When Sloan found out that his boss had handed in his resignation, he gave him an earful about ducking his responsibilities and how it wasn't what a good captain would do.
Ooh. And you're letting down all the people who elected you in. You made a promise when you were running that I'm going to represent you.
Exactly. And that's what Sloan hammered him on. Later, Sloan recalled that it took some convincing, but he finally got Dan to agree to rescind his resignation, saying, quote, I believe he absolutely recognized he had mental health problems, but finally he wasn't going to avoid his responsibilities.
But in hindsight, maybe he should have been allowed to just resign and move on.
Definitely. In hindsight, it's clear to see that. But that's not what they saw in the moment. Over that weekend, after he first resigned, Sloan's sentiments were reinforced to Dan by others. Upset constituents, friends, the police and fire union members were all calling, angry that he was giving up on his responsibilities to represent them. Dutifully, Dan went back to see George. And initially, George said he understood that Dan's resignation had been a knee-jerk reaction and handed him back his letter on November 18, 1978. To the press, George made the comment, quote, as far as I'm concerned, Dan White is the supervisor from District 8. A man has a right to change his mind. But reinstating Dan wasn't as easy as handing back a letter and pretending like things just didn't happen. In the time between him resigning and asking to rescind that resignation, other political moves were being made on the Board of Supervisors. Previous to Dan's resignation, there had been 5 liberal-orientated supervisors and 6 conservative ones. Now there was an opportunity to put a new face on the board, one that could possibly be more inclined to vote liberally on issues and help upset the conservative majority. Because of these maneuverings, mostly spearheaded by Harvey, George stalled on reinstating Dan, telling him that he would have to take some time to weigh the issue. Harvey was said to have been excited when he learned about Dan's resignation initially and told a friend, quote, it's just too good to believe. Now I've got my 6th vote.
Wow. Ouch.
Yeah.
Especially considering that these two began as friends and in agreement with a lot of things, most things.
And definitely had a mutual respect between the two of them.
He came to his son's baptism.
As Dan met with the Police Officers Association and the Board of Realtors that were stressing to him the importance that he keep his vote on the board for them, Harvey was meeting with the mayor and making their combined interests clear. Harvey stressed that reappointing Dan would jeopardize the mayor's agenda and suggested that it might also cause a loss of support for the mayor in the city's gay community, a constituency that had thrown a lot of support behind the mayor in his last election. After that meeting, George decided to take back his earlier position.
Ooh.
He balked at Dan's further request to reinstate him, and on November 20th told him in a letter, that Dan would now need to show support from his constituents that they wanted him reinstated. The letter from George indicated that he was going to take an additional week to review the situation.
Ooh, this is getting messy. Because you can see kind of all sides, but you do need someone on there who's not going to vote out of spite, who's going to actually do their job. It's not just to be there.
Right. And that wasn't the role that Dan was fulfilling at that time.
No.
And it was very clear. He wasn't hiding it, that he was being vindictive.
Yeah. And you can't have that.
No. In the following days, Dan worked to get his seat back, believing George was going to reinstate him if he could show the support from his constituents.
So now he's wanting it.
Yes. It sounds like he was almost guilt-tripped into it, though.
Okay.
A pile of petitions over an inch high was collected to support him in a single day by just one supporter. Dan said he tried to meet with the mayor, but he was being ghosted by him. Dan met with his attorney about a motion for a restraining order to prevent the filling of his vacant seat on the day after Thanksgiving. Later that same day, Dan's attorney presented an argument in a hearing before Judge Mayer, but the judge ruled that the resignation was binding, despite Dan's claim that the letter of resignation was submitted to the mayor when it actually should have been submitted to the president of the board.
And they no longer have the letter because the mayor gave it back to Dan.
Mm-hmm. None of it would make any difference, though, as the tragic events played out. Just after 11 p.m. on November 26th, after spending the day watching football, cleaning up around the house and reading, Dan learns from a KCBS reporter that George was not going to reappoint him. Instead, he would be replaced by a Liberal vote, no matter how much support he could prove. The reporter was after his reaction to the events that would take place the next day.
So his whole world is coming crashing down again, and he's going to feel like a failure.
Yep. And all of the work that he had just put in was for nothing.
Oh.
That night, Dan tosses and turns and is unable to sleep. On the morning of November 27th, Dan went into his home office in the basement of his house and loaded his police-issued 38 caliber gun and added an extra 10 bullets in his front pants pocket, wrapping them in a handkerchief so they wouldn't rattle.
Oh. Don't you have to return your gun when you quit the police force?
Apparently not.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting. I'm not sure if the rules are different place to place, but...
Or if they could be different now even, because this was a while ago.
Right. But he still did have his police issued 38. Interestingly, he lined his pocket with enough bullets to load that gun two more times.
Oh, that's a lot.
It
no wonder he needed fabric in there to stop them from jingling.
Yeah. His aide picked him up, not knowing what was in his pocket. And the two left for City Hall that morning around 10:15.
And this totally proves premeditation. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a heat of the moment thing.
It's interesting that you say that, Christy. Keep that thought. Earlier that morning, his aide had organized a rally to make it publicly known that Dan had supporters because there was a faulty report leaked to the media that only 30 people had signed petitions to keep him in office.
Oh, that's not very many.
That's not, but they had way more than that. And his aide knew that. So she had organized a rally that morning to go to City Hall as a visual representation of how much support he had.
Right. Way more than 30 people.
That's right. To discount this faulty report that was leaked to the media. The rally hadn't gone well, and the mayor had ducked out, refusing to meet with Dan's supporters. Now, arriving at City Hall around 10:30, Dan avoided the metal detectors at the main entrance by climbing into the building through a basement window that had been left open for ventilation.
Oh no.
The window was on the side of the building commonly used as a private entrance for employees. The door was typically kept locked and personnel had their own keys to get in. When an employee forgot their keys, it apparently wasn't uncommon for them to climb through this window because it was easily accessible and quite large.
Really?
Yes, I found this so odd. But there was testimony given during the trial that said it wasn't super unusual that somebody would be climbing through the window.
That's crazy.
I thought so too.
Because why even have a metal detector and make it difficult for people to come in the main entrance when they can just climb through the basement window, no problem?
Well, this one was an employee's only entrance.
So? You just have to walk around the building to figure that one out.
Yeah. They weren't expecting employees to be the threat.
No.
Dan was seen pacing in this lot beside the employee entrance for about 5 minutes and then climbing through the window. The employee that saw him stopped him and asked him what he was doing. Dan told him who he was, and he said that he had been waiting for his aide to come around and let him in, but she was taking too long, and so that's why he had climbed through the window. Once inside the building, he made his way to the mayor's office to speak with George. Dan would later claim that he simply wanted to ask the mayor about the prospects of his reappointment. He then claimed that upon being told that he would not be reappointed and that it was a, quote, political decision and that's the end of it, he got fuzzy and heard a roaring in his ears and said that he thought his head was going to burst. When George invited Dan into the back room for a drink after the discussion had upset him, Dan shot him twice in the body and twice in the back of the head while standing over the incapacitated father of four.
That's terrible.
Mm-hmm. One shot can be a snap judgment, but even after George was incapacitated, he stood over him and from less than a foot shot him another two times in the head.
He was out to kill.
Yeah. Then, Dan says, out of habit that he had learned as a police officer, he refilled the chamber in his gun, exited the back way out of the office, and proceeded across the building to Harvey's office. Again, during his confession, Dan would claim that he had no intention of harming Harvey. He claims that it was a coincidence that he just happened to see Harvey's aide and decided then to speak with him.
But he went over to where Harvey was.
Uh-huh.
That's not coincidental.
It's not.
You're climbing through basement windows to get to the mayor and then traveling over to Harvey's office.
Yep.
You didn't just stumble upon him in a park.
You reloaded your gun.
Yes.
Yeah.
With the pockets full of bullets that you brought with you.
Yep. When Dan entered Harvey's office, he said he simply wanted to talk about what he felt was Harvey's, quote, masterminding to keep him off the board. During that conversation, Dan said that he, quote, got all flushed, and that's when Harvey smirked at him, and the shooting began. He raised the gun and shot him three times in his body and twice in the back of his head, again standing over his prone and incapacitated victim. Dan ran from the scene, collecting keys from his aide, and fled out of City Hall.
Which means he knew what he did was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And because he smirked at you, your ego is that fragile that you're going to kill a man for that.
He was known for snap judgments, knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah, but you're an adult. Come on.
You need to learn to control yourself.
Yeah, and if you can't, then you get to go to jail.
Yep. Dan arranged to meet Mary Ann at St. Mary's Cathedral. After they met, the two drove to the police station where Dan surrendered to police and gave his confession. At 11:20 that same morning, barely an hour after Dan had left his house, the board's president gave a press conference and told reporters that, quote, both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Milk Harvey had been shot and killed. Supervisor Dan White is the suspect.
So terrible.
Yeah. It's just so sad because they were all doing really great things for the community. They were all fighting a good fight.
Oh, definitely.
Dan was interrogated at 12:05, right after turning himself in at the Hall of Justice. He was very emotional and teary. One of the interrogating officers who had worked with Dan in the past called Dan a shattered individual that day. Watching and reading the transcript are two very different experiences, and different angles to the interview can be seen.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. If you just read the transcript, it makes it pretty clear that the interrogating officers just let Dan tell his version of the events without a whole lot of questions being asked. Throughout his narrative, he continually says that he had no intention of killing anyone and that he doesn't really understand why he took a gun to City Hall that day or how he ended up shooting two people. He talks about the pressure that he was under and then somehow he was just shooting a gun.
Like he was a victim of circumstance.
Yes. Bizarrely, or maybe not so bizarrely, when you're reading the statement, the police didn't question any of the things that he was telling them. He's giving these answers, and just as he starts to talk about the amount of bullets that he took with him, something that I think could have been used to show intent, the officers end the interrogation by thanking him for being so forthcoming.
What?
Yes. It is the most abrupt end to an interrogation that I have seen. And right at a part when I was expecting them to start asking questions to establish his thought process, like, why did you pack extra bullets and why 10? And
yeah, this is when the hard hitting should begin.
Right.
Not stepping back.
Exactly. But the interview just ends with the officer saying, I appreciate your cooperation for the truthfulness in your statement. At this time, we'll close the statement. And it's now 12:30 in the afternoon. Thank you.
Do you think that they didn't want him to further incriminate himself?
When I read it, that's the impression I get. It ended 25 minutes after the interview began.
Yeah, that's not very long for a confession.
It's not. But watching the interview does show a different kind of angle on it. It shows these two officers watching a man fall completely apart. He is really emotional. And at the end of the interview, it almost seems like the officer's being sympathetic to an old friend and less conspiracy-ish.
So because he was upset and sad.
Right. But still, it's a 25-minute interrogation of a dirtbag that's confessing to murdering two people in cold blood.
Yeah. And why are we so worried about him boo-hooing when George's family, his wife and children, now don't have a father or a husband? And Harvey's partner has now suffered a great loss as well in all of his family.
Exactly.
No one's there to stop and dry their tears from the police station.
It's true. But when you watch the interview, you can tell that the officers know him. And it seems heart-wrenching.
Okay.
When you read it on paper, like I said, it's a completely different experience than when you watch the interview.
So they're feeling some empathy for him.
Definitely. As Dan was arrested and processed that night, an extremely large crowd of people marched from the Castro to City Hall to show respect for the fallen mayor and the leader of San Francisco's gay movement. The outrage was palpable in the city. Media had a field day covering the story of a conservative bigot gunning down two city officials, officials that were well connected to the LGBTQ community. George was considered a gay sympathizer, and Harry was the beloved social activist and proclaimed leader of the movement.
Yeah, he was.
Mm-hmm. At this time, San Francisco was quickly becoming the hub for the LGBTQ movement. Newspapers had been running stories about Dan's recent behavior and how he had been trying to overthrow Harvey's initiatives and fighting against equal rights for LGBTQ. Rumors started to circulate about how Dan had held so much hatred against all gay men that he couldn't stand to work with Harvey anymore, and that's why he shot him. Rumors circulated that Dan was in the back pockets of the police department, who were presented as known haters of the LGBTQ community, going as far to claim that when Dan walked into the precinct where he used to work to confess, he was greeted with cheers and applause for his actions.
Do you think that's true?
No, I don't.
I don't either. No. I can't imagine.
The rumors that were going around were just crazy, and the media was pushing them all.
Oh, so it was just growing, too.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that that's not true.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Another rumor tried to explain the hatred by insinuating that Dan had been in the closet about his own sexuality, and that's why he had targeted George and Harvey. If I have learned anything from doing this podcast, it's that you really have to fact check. All of these rumors heightened political tensions and brought awareness to the LGBTQ movement, but most of them were very hard to substantiate. Dan and his family denied that he was gay, outright denied it. Their denial doesn't really confirm anything. They could have been lying, but he does go on to have two more children with his wife.
Okay. So if it was an internal struggle, it's nothing that he ever dealt with.
That's right.
If it was at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sloan, who was Dan's campaign manager, partner in his business, and was close to Dan in the last 2 years leading up to the murders, was gay himself and said that it was a non-issue between him and Dan. He 100% denies that Dan was homophobic or held any animosity towards the LGBTQ movement.
Okay, that seems a little more legit then.
Yeah.
If it's coming from someone who worked close by his side, you would think that he would have picked that up. And if Dan was so homophobic, there's no way he would have hired a gay man to be his aide.
No. And Sloan just said it was like a non-issue. He was just this guy.
Yeah. And I don't think that he was, because in the beginning, he voted with Harvey.
Exactly. If you dig a little bit deeper into any of the votes that he made in that year in office, most of them were for gay rights movements and supporting Harvey. It was only in the last section that he really went crazy into town and started fighting against everything that Harvey put forward.
Right. But that was more having a temper tantrum because he didn't get his way.
Exactly. The motive wasn't that he hated the LGBTQ community, but that's what the media grabbed onto.
Yeah, that is the story that you hear quite often.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the police department denied that there was any cheering when Dan confessed.
I hope that there wasn't.
Yeah, I hope so too.
If there was, I hope they all stub their toe every day for the rest of their lives.
But rumors continued to circulate, and it built up tensions in the LGBT community as Dan was put on trial for the murders of George Moscone and Harvey Milk on May 1st, 1979. They wasted no time seeking justice, and they didn't take any chances with security. A thick shield of bulletproof glass separated the gallery from the forward arena, occupied by the judge, prosecutors, attorneys, defendant, and the jury. And everyone had to pass through a metal detector. There was no sneaking in the windows.
Did they lock all the basement windows?
Yeah, hopefully. The prosecution quickly and neatly laid out the case for the first-degree murder over just 3 days. In hindsight, looking at the trial proceedings, the prosecution seemed inept. They didn't challenge a lot of issues that I felt could have been challenged, especially when it came to jury selection. But then maybe they thought that it was a slam-dunk case, because it should have been. They argued that there was premeditation. Dan had brought a gun and a specific number of bullets with him.
And he had tried to hide the fact that he was carrying it.
Mm-hmm. It may have been believable that it was routine and for self-protection that Dan had carried his gun to City Hall that day. But someone thinking about self-defense doesn't usually bring extra bullets.
No, and even Dan himself said, "I don't know why I brought it that day." He did not say, "I'm always packing."
During the trial, it came out that several politicians did carry guns into City Hall for their own protection, and Dan had, on occasion in the past, brought his gun. And it was more to do with the movement of the Black Panthers threatening him.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they were allowed to when they would go through the metal detector?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So if they were allowed to, then that adds extra suspicion, I feel like, that he didn't just go through the metal detector, that he went through the basement window.
Well, the prosecution argues that him going through the basement window was purposely done and showed a deliberate action of him trying to avoid the metal detectors. But the defense has several people testify that most employees entered through this side door, and if they didn't have their key, then they would go through the window.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But Dan had waited patiently to see George and had asked others to wait as he went in to see Harvey because he, quote, had something to do.
Hmm. Not something to discuss. I have something to do.
That's right. And there was definitely malice. Both George and Harvey had stopped Dan from getting what he wanted, and he was angry at both of them.
Absolutely. And he didn't just shoot them once and run. He waited till he could stand above them and make sure that they were dead.
Yeah. The dirtbag Dan's defense was diminished capacity. His lawyers argued that he was a troubled and depressed man that snapped under terrible financial and family pressures. They used Dan's friends. I see your head.
Yeah, no, I ain't buying it. Return to sender.
It is bizarre that they are able to mount this defense.
Yeah, he definitely had in his mind a perceived motive, but it's not an excusable defense.
No.
If that was the case, everyone would literally be running around shooting each other because we all have
stressors.
Yeah, stress in our life.
Yep.
And if you don't, good for you. But most people, I think, are struggling in one way or another. It's not all sunshine and roses all of the time.
We all have to learn to give and take and navigate the world with other people that sometimes we necessarily don't get along with.
Right. We all have to dust ourselves off and get up and try again or try something different.
Right.
Because we all fail at certain things too.
Yep. But the defense team used Dan's friends and psychiatrists to testify that Dan in the months leading up to the murders had displayed signs of erratic decision-making that affected his job and his lifestyle. They said he would become withdrawn and lethargic for days at a time and was making snap decisions without consulting anybody. The defense argued that a good person like Dan, who defended the average citizen from crime and political corruption, didn't just go and shoot people out of the blue without having undergone some, quote, vile biochemical change. A series of psychiatrists testified that Dan was so depressed, so sleep deprived, so bloated on junk food that he had been continually eating the night before, that he lacked the capacity to premeditate and deliberate what was required to convict him of first-degree murder. The psychiatrist, Martin Blinder, stated that on the night before the murders, Dan was, quote, getting depressed about the fact that he would not be reappointed. He just sat there in front of the TV set, binging on Twinkies. These statements spawned the term Twinkie defense in the media, and it has since become the term synonymous with an improbable defense or one that is artificial or absurd. The term has earned its place in law dictionaries, social textbooks, college exams, and has more than 28,000 references on Google.
Wow. The Twinkie defense.
The Twinkie defense.
And I wonder if the company that makes Twinkies is like, hey, thanks for the publicity.
It was all negative publicity, though.
But it's still getting their name out. It makes you want a Twinkie.
It is true. But the company came out and made a statement that the notion that overdosing on cream-filled goodies could lead to murderous behavior was poppycock or crap. In actuality, the psychiatrist hadn't been blaming Twinkies for Dan's actions at all, but he was using Dan's consumption of all of this extra junk food as proof that he was in a depressed state. But the media just grabbed on to this story that would sell, and legal history was made.
Wow, that is incredible.
From one little statement made at a trial, we have this term that has been in the media now for over almost 50 years.
And is being taught in schools.
Yes.
That's interesting.
So crazy to me. But it just shows you how you can take a story from many different angles and change it.
Yeah, because it was not because he was eating too many Twinkies.
No, it wasn't at all. The defense, though, latched onto this idea as a way to confuse the issue with the jurors and sell their defense. They presented research that supported the idea that when eaten in large quantities by susceptible individuals, high sugar foods with lots of preservatives, like a Twinkie, can cause antisocial and violent behavior. The defense actually worked, and diminished capacity was the reason the jury accepted for why Dan had murdered two people.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Can sugar and preservatives actually do that to you?
There are some studies that say it can change your brain chemistry, but I don't think to the point where you would actually murder people.
And just from a one-night binge, because they said it was the night before that he was eating all of this stuff.
Right. He had been eating more and more of these high-sugar junk food items since the summer.
Okay.
So it wasn't just that one night, but that one night he had definitely binged on it. Of course, the jury made this decision after it was played the video of Dan's very emotionally distraught confession, and the defense masterfully steered any discussion on motive away from the political climate that was going on at City Hall and made very poignant comparisons between Harvey's overly homosexual lifestyle and Dan's all-American background.
Oh, that's a dirtbag move.
It was. But the jury, many of whom were working-class conservative Catholics, declared after 36 hours of deliberation that Dan was guilty, quote, only of voluntary manslaughter in the killings of both Moscone and Milk, deeming that he was in a diminished state when the murders were completed.
Wow.
It's just wild to me.
That is. Because to me, it just seems that it was more double homicide of revenge. Because George wasn't part of the LGBTQ community.
No, it was that Dan was a dirtbag and couldn't take failure.
Right. He felt that these two men, regardless of their political views or their backgrounds, had wronged him and they had to pay.
That's right. They hadn't been out front with him. They hadn't been honest with him.
And were going against him.
Yes. One juror said after the trial that, quote, it sounded like Dan White had hypoglycemia as an excuse for why Dan wasn't able to tell right from wrong. And I thought, this statement just proves how impressionable that they were to the defense's crafty arguments. And the reports of the jury being swayed by his confession tape were actually what made me go back and watch it and not just read it. Because at first, when I was doing my research, I just read it. And I was like, oh, they're totally letting him off. They're totally not asking him questions so he doesn't incriminate himself. But then when you go back and watch it, it is quite emotional. And I can see how the jury would be swayed a little bit by it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know how you would live with yourself after that. It would be so horrific because I don't think Dan started out as a really bad guy.
I don't think initially he was a dirtbag.
But he definitely evolved into one.
Mm-hmm. Following the announcement of the verdict, what began as a peaceful demonstration in San Francisco's Castro district turned into an angry mob. A throng of thousands chanted things like, quote, avenge Harvey Milk and kill Dan White. They began marching towards City Hall. Some members of the crowd hurled stones through the windows of City Hall, while others ripped grillwork off the doors. When police appeared, they were greeted with a barrage of rocks and chunks of asphalt that people had actually ripped from the street.
Holy.
and chrome that they had ripped off of city buses. Cables from the street trolleys were pulled down, and 13 police cars were set on fire that night. Police responded with tear gas and beatings.
Oh my goodness.
Later that night, they entered the nightclub, the Elephant Walk, a gay bar, and assaulted patrons there. Each side was filled with anger, and the violence just escalated. At the end, it would become known as the White Knights Riot. 124 people were injured, including 59 policemen, and millions of dollars in damage were done to city property. That's how high tensions were and how much anger there was over this verdict.
Yeah, you can definitely see how emotionally charged everyone would have been at that time. Because for the LGBTQ community, I can't speak for them, but just from what you've told me, I can see how they would feel that this was representative of how they were being treated and what they were fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
It would have felt like a huge punch in the gut because he should not have gotten voluntary manslaughter.
No, it should have been first degree murder.
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this was a conservative man with the white picket fence and the 2.5 kids or whatever, if he would have gotten the same sentence or if the roles were reversed.
Well, I think the jury selection had a lot to do with his verdict.
Yeah. So definitely could have been some bias there.
Oh, there was huge bias. There is bias all over this.
Wow.
Yeah. On July 3rd, 1979, after tempers had barely had time to cool down, Dan White was sentenced to 7 years and 8 months in prison.
Oh, Melissa.
The sentence was believed by many as an insult to the two men that had lost their lives and the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, it was an insult.
Mm-hmm.
People can go to school for longer than that for their careers, let alone go to jail for killing two people.
A Twinkie has a shelf life of 7 years.
Well, actually, I've heard Twinkies can last indefinitely. If you are going into a zombie apocalypse, you want to fill your backpack with Twinkies because they got you. And no, this is not a paid endorsement.
Well, the shelf life is 7 years.
That's a little poetic.
Yeah. On January 7th, 1984, Dan was released early.
Early?
Early. After serving only 5 years, 1 month, and 9 days.
Come on.
Yeah. He was let out for good behavior.
Who cares? That's aggravating.
It was so wild to me.
Two men's lives are worth 2.5 years each?
Mm-hmm.
That is despicable.
It's so sad. Dan was told to stay out of the San Francisco area. He spent his 1 year probation in Southern California. When his probation ended, he returned to his family, but his marriage by that time was falling apart. On October 21st, 1985, less than 2 years after his release, Dan, at the age of 39, ran a hose from the exhaust pipe in his family's car to the inside where he sat and inhaled the carbon monoxide. His body was discovered by his youngest brother, Thomas, shortly after 2 p.m. the same day. He died clutching family photos and listening to a loop tape of an Irish ballad song. He left behind Marianne and their 3 small children.
So did they have 2 children while he was in prison?
They had the one when he was first elected. One of them was conceived while he was in prison. And then I think the other one was born afterwards.
When he was let out.
Mm-hmm.
How horrific for his brother to find him that way.
It's so sad.
Poor wife, too.
Yeah.
So do you think he ended his life because of guilt?
Well, it didn't come as a surprise to many that knew him. He had refused therapy when he was incarcerated. And while he didn't openly express remorse for any of his actions, it was clear to a lot of people that knew him that he wasn't coping well, and it only got worse once he was released. He left 3 suicide notes behind. One was addressed to his wife, one to his mother, and the 3rd note was taped to the windshield of the car, was unaddressed, but it was pretty clear it was meant for his brother who found him. When the media reported his death, one man was seen dancing in the street in the gay Castro district singing, quote, "Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead."
Wow.
People to this day still have very strong feelings about the dirtbag Dan White. Years after the trial, Dan's defense attorney said he couldn't even remember the name Twinkies ever being mentioned in the testimonies. And his other defense attorney attributed Dan's motives to his periodic bouts of depression and the mechanisms of dirty politics at City Hall. It's not a motive that's bought by everyone today. Some still believe that it was a police conspiracy that ordered Dan and then protected him to murder 2 powerful political individuals And possibly even more at City Hall that day. And that's why he had the extra bullets.
What?
Mm-hmm. But then there have been some, too, that believe Twinkies were responsible as well.
That is a lot of differing opinions.
Yeah. There are a lot of different motives in this one. But that is the case of the once upon a time public hero turned disturbed dirtbag, Dan White, whose despicable actions were driven by political agendas and angles. And I don't think by Twinkies.
Yeah, I'm not buying the Twinkie defense. But that was a very interesting case. I learned so much from you telling it to me today. And I hope, listeners, that you guys learned something too. I'm very curious what all of you think.
It is interesting to relook at a case almost 50 years after the fact, because a lot of the books and a lot of the documentaries were over 20 years ago.
Right. But what we do know is that Dan was a dirtbag. Even if he started out as a community hero, he definitely turned into a dirtbag. And there were so many victims in that case.
So many victims, especially if you consider the community at large that could no longer be served by George and Harvey.
Absolutely.
There could have been so much more good done by those two people.
Oh, I totally agree.
It's just so sad that they were ended early by Dirtbag Dan.
Yeah, because he was having a temper tantrum. I don't think he could regulate his emotions. He proved that by voting vindictively after they didn't vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
You were right, Melissa. It was interesting to hear all the different sides of the story and the different theories on why this happened. And perhaps it wasn't just for one reason. Perhaps it wasn't just political or him being against the LGBTQ community. Perhaps it was both.
It can always be both, Christy.
Yeah, it definitely could be more than one motivating factor in this case.
And I always find it so interesting to discuss the motives of these dirtbags. And we'll be back again next week with Christy to discuss more motives.
Oh, Melissa, I do have a wild one picked out for you. I know you're going to be with me, but listeners, I hope that you'll join us then as well.
Until then.
See ya.
Bye.
Hello? Are you there?
I am here.
Hello?
I am here. Still here.
She's like, only my mother would send me a picture of a literal grave and ask me a question.
Look at all I can do.
Without tapping my mic.
There we go. Now you can see me and I can see my screen.
Okay.
It's a fabulous setup, people.
We are very technical. We have all the bells and whistles. I'm not using dollar store baskets to prop my phone up or Melissa's laptop.
It's fabulous. Works well. Dan left the DePlease. The DePlease. After leaving the DePlease. DePlease.
You really want to get the DePlease?
The DePlease are going to go.
Please, DePlease. We could say it's our country, but then we might get arrested. Quite literally. You can cut that out or put it in the bloopers, but it's true.
Dan White made up the fifth newcomer.
New cucumber?
Yeah, cucumber.
All I can picture is Sean Penn.
Yeah, I'll just skip that.
Do you think of Mark Sloan when you hear the word Sloan? To me, that's Sloan.
The psychiatrist, Merton Blind.
Merton?
Merton.
Great, I shouldn't laugh. But I'm just thinking, that's me on every Friday night.
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top five favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah, did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many rogues that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. the Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.